Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Melting Pot podcast. I'm your host, Dominic Monkhouse. The Melting Pot is as a result of my hunger for optimizing business performance, scaling up organizations, corporate culture, customer addiction, building high-performing teams, along with a few other obsessions along the way. I've spent the last several years working for and with some of the most successful top-performing companies in the world. And this podcast is my attempt to synthesize what I've learned along the way to help you build a high-quality business and live a more fulfilling life. If you enjoy the podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at dominicmonkhouse.com. Hello, welcome to The Melting Pot. Today, I'm talking to Sander Arts. He is a marketing guru who now has left his native Netherlands and lives in Silicon Valley. He is a man with multiple jobs. He works as a CMO or fractional CMO with a number of organizations, one of which is I interviewed the CEO of Bear Conductive a couple of shows ago. And so that's how we got to know each other. We talk about China, how to do business in China. We talk about his book, Cut the Bullshit Marketing, where he and some other blunt Dutchmen got together and came up with what it is that companies really need to know about marketing. How do you make it customer to customer? How do you run programs that drive ROI? So we chat about that. We chat about some of the other things that are happening in Silicon Valley and things that are changing the world from an IoT perspective. Really enjoyed my chat with Sander today. Hope you enjoy it too.
Hi, this is Sander Arts. I'm based in Silicon Valley in California. I have been here for the last 10 years. I'm the founder of a consultancy firm called Orange Tulip, and people hire me for business development, strategic marketing, and partnerships.
And you're an author as well.
And I'm an author, yeah. I am.
And a lecturer?
Yes. Yeah. There's, you know, and a CMO and a fractional CMO. The thing is, I was born and raised in the Netherlands. My mom told us to not be overly boasting about the things that you're doing. So, and which is difficult because in the US, everything is award winning. I'm also an award winning author and CMO, but you know.
So where should we start? Look, maybe we dive into the book and start there. So why did you write another book on marketing?
Yeah, well, there's no shortage of books in marketing, to your implicit point. We've set out and we said, this is not going to be the best book about marketing, but we had to get a few things off our chest. So we did, right? And I got pushed out of a company in an acquisition along with the rest of the management team in 2016. And when somebody gives you a little bit of money and a little bit of time, you think you have to do a whole bunch of things, which I did and we did. And one of them was writing this book. And the book is, in our opinion, and that's also being confirmed by the market, interesting because it talks about the very difficult space to do marketing in, which is semiconductors and hardware and like deep technology. And it turns out that there is quite a bit of agreement in the market around that particular premise. So we wrote a book and we're actually pretty successful, and it's being used at a variety of universities, including INSEAD, Carnegie Mellon, and Stanford.
Okay. Why are semiconductors and hardware hard? Because you've got to talk features and benefits, which you don't want to do?
That's exactly right. Right. Most people will go to market and say, hey, you know, here's my next great semiconductor. Let's just keep this super simple. And everybody has a speeds and feeds communication and marketing. At least not everybody, but in 90% of the cases, that's probably true. And we have always gone against the grain and made sure that there was different kind of marketing. Turns out that the battle within the company is probably even larger than the battle outside, right? Because once you start talking to your target audience and once you start marketing, it turns out that people out there in the market really truly appreciate the fact that you are telling them a different kind of story over and beyond speeds and feeds.
And so what things have you found that have worked that you've, you know, the nuggets in the book?
One of the key things that we advocate in the book is that everything needs to be people to people, right? There is a tendency to do these broad strokes, mass market kind of generic messages kind of marketing. Turns out that if you pay a little more attention, that there is actually quite a bit of granularity within the target audiences. And if you craft your messages accordingly and you find these people on the channels or community sites or wherever, where they are, right, and where they engage, it turns out you can have very, very interesting outcomes and impact.
Make the customer story the hero.
That's exactly right. And there's quite a few incredibly passionate people out there, as you can imagine, that are discussing technology and trying to make the right decisions in buying the right product. And if you instill the right messages in those customer journeys, there is actually very significant ROI. And the book describes a few strategies, but also examples, because we also wanted this book to be some sort of a story book. So there's multiple ways of reading it. You can do the high level read. You can also look at the theoretical examples. But I myself think that some of the stories that are in there are actually more appealing. I don't want to give everything away, but there's some interesting stories where we engaged in Twitter battles with world famous rappers in the US. Another story is where we got invited to the White House by President Obama when he was president a few years ago in the White House. So the company had an opportunity to represent itself in the White House at the annual White House Maker Fair. And there's a whole story in the book as to how that went down.
All of which are fantastic. But one of the other things that struck me about the book is that you're more about return on investment than about brand and awareness.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes these things go hand in hand, right? But early on in my career, I realized that, I'll give it to you as a story, right? So I would have to go and update the executive management team, and I would walk into the room where all the executives sat and they were on their computers, and they looked up and you could see these people relax. And after a few of these sessions, it dawned on me that I was no threat, which is probably good news, but also bad news. And everybody was like, oh, the head of marketing, this is going to be fun for an hour or whatever. And I, at a certain point in time, pretty early on, I decided I did not want to be the head of corporate entertainment. So I decided to sort of change the story, right? Because you have the tendency to go in and say, hey, you know, look, we were at this trade show and we did a number of press releases and we got picked up here and there. And then here's the key spokespeople that were featured in magazine A, B, and C. And so we changed the narrative, started running digital campaigns that you can measure. And I went back into the boardroom with statistics or numbers, right? Measurement associated with sales potential and leads and qualified leads and identified revenue associated with a marketing campaign. And now you can show a return on investment and everybody starts to care even more over and beyond the stories that you're telling. And of course, there's some brand related activity in there, because if you run your campaigns well, there's no doubt going to be quite a bit of positive pour over into your brand. But the meat mostly sits in these digital campaigns.
Yeah, but it's amazing how many people still have a job in marketing and don't see sales as part of their measurement criteria.
Yeah, and it's a shame, you know. I would talk to my team and say, I don't think you went to school for like forever to go and join a team where you're being used by the business units for execution work that doesn't even make a lot of sense. And you go from one product launch to the other. And why aren't we changing this thing so that we become the hero of the company? Now, I've also always realized that this isn't about making the marketing teams the heroes, because we're still at the service of the business, but it can be both, right? And in some of the companies that I worked for, including Philips and NXP Semiconductors and Atmel Corporation, we did just that. We got the respect from the organization, which I think highly educated people in marketing teams deserve. And we were able to contribute significantly to the bottom line of the company.
Yes, I meet organizations all the time who you get a sense that they don't know why they're doing it, because when they say, well, you know, when we get ready to sell and we want to make more money, we'll just cut marketing. And in fact, if they wanted to exit the business and they wanted to sell it and their marketing was actually working, they'd spend more on it. And the story for the exit would be, and if you have more money than we do, you could spend even more and the business could grow even faster. It's incredible how many executives and businesses just have such low expectations of their marketing team. And then those expectations are met.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, and I don't think they have seen it done well, right? So if you've been in these companies and semiconductor is probably notorious, and you have seen people come into your boardroom telling you about how big the trade show booth was and how many press releases they did and how many people they were able to train on the product, then that's it. And then all of a sudden there's somebody else that comes in and tells a different story and wants to be measured against success of the company and his or her contributions to the bottom line. You really significantly change the narrative within the boardroom. And the proof of that particular premise is the fact that all the CEOs that I worked for have endorsed the book, them and Stanford University, and also one of the largest private equity firms, KKR. So these people have seen the benefit from the approach. And I think it's only good because it's a win-win-win situation, right, for the company, for the teams, but also, frankly, for the market, because they get something that is a little different and better than the marketing that they're normally exposed to.
And Sander, we were talking a little bit before we pressed record, and you've now turned the book into a training course. Does somebody buy the training course, or do they turn up to you and get trained? What's the...
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? So we wrote the book. Turns out that we still had a lot to learn, because when I gave people the book, they would come back to me and say, hey, you know, this isn't a book about marketing. This is about agile development, or this is about agile marketing, or this is about disruptive thinking or whatever. And I'm like, okay, well, interesting. The other question or comment that I got from people is they said, how did you go about all of this and how can we learn? Which, I mean, the book in itself is relatively straightforward and simple, we believed, and it has the theoretical models associated with the things we believe you have to do to be effective. Turns out people want to be taken by the hand a little bit more, and it turns out that in some cases it actually takes a little longer than just reading a book. So we decided to really productize it, and we spent 9 months, so we spent actually quite a bit of time, and I partnered with a good friend of mine here in Silicon Valley. His name is Jack Keenan, who has been in the training business for almost 30 years. So we took his approach and his IP and his thinking, combined it with the book, and the output of that is a very comprehensive, detailed training course that is also being supported by his trainers who have been training people for 30 years. Because I wanted to make sure we did that professionally and not just me sort of hacking something together from my kitchen, right? So Jack B. Keenan is famous in the sales side of the business and the training associated with it.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we'll link to both of those in the show notes so people can have a look at that. But there's another, I suppose it's topical at the moment given the sort of US-China trade war, but you've spent quite a lot of your time working in and around China and are quite an advocate for collaborating with China, aren't you?
I am. Oh, yeah, certainly. I was in China a few weeks ago because I'm doing some work for Arduino in Italy. I advised the CEO and co-founders on doing more business, and China, of course, being one of them. It's interesting because when I worked for Philips, I would go to China, and Philips was, as you know, the first foreign company over 120 years ago to do business in China. And every single person in China knows the Philips brand. So I would go and I would be celebrated for the fact that I worked for Philips and we would have great business collaboration. And it all changed a little bit when I moved to the US, where I didn't really find warm reception when I would go visit China. Turns out the Chinese don't really understand the Dutch accents. So I think they thought I was an American. This is probably not the most popular point of view that I've ever taken, but I'm going to go there anyway. Right. So I think that deep competition between China and America hasn't really helped in certain cases. Now, all the people that I have always done business with in China have been incredibly good to me and the businesses that I represented. So yeah, I'm actually talking to quite a few of the Chinese companies, and I think that there's a lot to collaborate on. Now, of course, just to sort of make a bit of an official statement, I do not approve of all the things that have happened that have sharpened the relationships between America and China, but I do believe that there's a lot of ground to collaborate on outside of some of those issues that have to be resolved.
And what are the challenges for businesses doing work in China now?
First off, this is super lame, but it's language, right? It's still difficult to go and cross the bridge and make sure that your messages and marketing materials translate into Mandarin or simplified Chinese or whatever is needed. There is no lack of appetite from the Chinese to collaborate and do business, which has always been great. Increasingly over the years, and I've been visiting China for probably close to 25 years now, you see a deep desire to wanting to play in the global economy, where like 20 years ago, they'd sort of serve their own market. I've had some instances where people say, you know, we'll take over all your manufacturing and all your logistics for the world. I like that ambition in some cases. It may be a little bit too big of an ambition, but there is still a lot of ground to collaborate on.
And have you mostly been working for Western firms trying to sell into China, or have you also had experiences where you've been working with Chinese firms helping them grow that global market?
I'm talking to a few, and I have talking to a few firms in China. As you can imagine, there is quite a few changes that have happened in the semiconductor industry, where I think the Chinese have realized that they can't always rely on the Western innovation technology coming out of, like, let's say, Western semiconductor companies. So you see a very large investment in China, and these people need expertise and, in my case, maturity, which just comes over the years, unfortunately and fortunately, from people that have been doing business in this particular space. So I am, and I'm deliberately a little vague, but I am talking to a few of the Chinese players to make sure that they make the right decisions, because that's where there's a big investment in semiconductors, but also technology in general as we speak. And it has been, but it's gotten a little bit more heated up in light of all the conversations that have happened in, let's say, the last, I don't know, I guess 24 months.
Yeah. And your sort of expertise in semiconductors, then the Arduino stuff, you're now heavily involved in all things IoT. What are the interesting things you're seeing in the IoT space out of Silicon Valley?
So, you know, IoT has been around as a buzzword for, I don't know, probably more than 10 years now. I think it took a while for people to really be able to understand what was going on. I think everybody understood that everything is going to be smart and connected, but it turns out that that market is very scattered, right? So you have the people that are connecting diapers to your phone as much as you have people that are connecting your coffee pot to your phone as much as you have people that are trying to build connected pet and dogs kind of solutions. The underlying technology is mostly the same, right? You need some kind of a microprocessor, you need some kind of connectivity, and if you have more secure data, you need some security. But the problem is that there's many people doing many things. So the IoT world is interesting. But then I'll give you another example. I bumped into a company called Bear Conductive in the UK. And Bear Conductive started out as the developer of development kits for education. And they have and had created conductive paint. Turns out that paintable IoT all of a sudden is an option. And new applications of companies, and I'll give you an example, like IKEA, for example, that are trying to get into the smart home are all of a sudden very, very possible by the sheer fact that you can turn any single surface into a smart surface with the bare conductive technology. So there's new developments in IoT where the IoT market as a market has been around for a long time, but you see different kind of applications, right? You can imagine that if you were to put conductive paint and make surfaces smart, you would do that in buildings, for example, within the isolation of the building, or there's a product in America called Tyvek. And this is just a theoretical example, right? But you could turn any single building into a smart building. But the same goes for cars, et cetera, et cetera. So smartness that is going to surround us and stuff that's going to be generating data is certainly happening. I don't know whether that's purely a Silicon Valley thing. Everybody always asks me that question, right? I'm very close to the people in Eindhoven back in the Netherlands, where Philips used to have the world's third largest privately owned research facility. There's amazing technology in Eindhoven and incredibly smart people. It's just not called Silicon Valley, but I see equal amount of smartness and brains there, as much as I see the same thing in Guangdong, where I was, and Shenzhen, where I was a few weeks ago.
Yeah, people hype up anything that comes out of Silicon Valley, I guess.
Yeah, which is good because it helps my hourly rate.
What other companies are you involved in that are doing? You're involved in a supercomputer software defined compute business as well?
Yeah, there's a company called Grok here in Mountain View. Grok is building the next generation of compute, and I can't give you too much details, but within the next 3 to 6 months, the world will meet Grok, and we are very, very excited about the opportunity that we have, but also the technology has, for a world that is going to require an incredible amount of compute, and where we believe that the current solutions aren't sufficient. That's all I can say. But it's exciting in the sense that I've helped a whole bunch of companies in the last 4 years of me running my business. This company has gathered an insane amount of talent. There are some ex-TensorFlow Google people there who have been able to get incredible talent from NVIDIA and Intel and a lot of other places in the technology world. And when I walked in there, all I could think is, I guess these people hired me to make sure that I lowered the IQ in some of these meetings. Because it's insane. And I'm super excited about that company. And there's going to be more. Maybe we can dedicate something else a little later to it, because I think the world's going to be intrigued with what's going to happen coming out of that company.
Yeah, that would be great. What else are you involved in at the moment? That's, I'm sure the others are all sexy and exciting as well. What else are you?
Well, the Arduino one is interesting in the sense that there's a community of over 30 million people on an annual basis visiting our website, engaging with our technology, and Arduino is lowering the threshold for people to enter IoT, right? Companies that are traditionally not in technology at all, right? There's like stone-crushing companies and companies that have huge fleets of tractors or whatever, all of a sudden realize that they have to go through digital transformation. That digital transformation can relatively easily happen on the back of the use of Arduino. And we've been able to successfully launch additional products, as much as we have created a cloud so that people can easily connect whatever device they want to connect, right? Stone crushing machines or oil pressure measurement, or where's my tractor at this particular point in time, generate the data and pull it from the cloud in a super easy way without having to go to Amazon or whatever and make huge investments. So Arduino is very, very interesting because that's where I get mostly exposed to the diverse world of IoT and people wanting to also make the world a better place, which is incredibly important, as we all know, if you believe all the articles that are out there right now, which I think we should, just to be sure that we don't ruin this planet, which I think we already are.
And that Arduino, there's a huge community sharing all of this development effort online, or is some of it in pockets of sort of commercial development on an open source hardware platform?
It's both, right? So if you go to the Arduino website, you can see what is going on within the community. There is also a project hub where people are posting their projects, and you see projects varying from the ones that I mentioned as an example, also to like smart gardening products and IoT devices. It's interesting because if you look at crowdfunding sites and you type in Arduino, you'll see that the bulk of the prototypes are being developed on Arduino hardware.
Yeah. Were the founders of that business surprised with the success of the organization?
They developed something that is so easy to use that anyone can use it. And there's examples of 6-7-year-old children that have successfully created businesses on the back of using Arduino. They set out to help education and get people educated on the use of technology by building the initial Arduino board, called the Arduino Uno, which is even in museums in the UK. That's how impactful that technology has been. And it just progressed, right? In the meantime, there is multiple dozens of people around the globe in Arduino offices bringing new technology to market. But also, we have created a dedicated education business unit. And there is amazing products coming out of the education business unit targeted to younger age, but all the way up to like engineering schools around the world. And the products there, because it's based off of Arduino, obviously, are flying off the shelves right now. So there's a lot of Arduino within education at every single level all over the world, because we have cracked the code on being able to build translations for all the materials.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. And is you're still lecturing at Stanford?
Yeah, so when we wrote the book, I was lucky enough to get Baba Sheaf, who's a marketing professor at Stanford, to endorse it. Then a little while ago, Stanford got a new dean, and I think the dean had made the decision that they don't want outside speakers anymore, which is a bit of a shame. So it's been a little quiet in the last period, but I'm still very much engaged. There is a Stanford business case, which we created on the back of my marketing experiences at Admel, that is turned into a business case. And that business case is still being used within Stanford's executive MBA education. As much, it's also being used around the world because it's free for people to download it. I got an email from a big MBA school out of India the other day, where people said, "Ah, yeah, we're getting trained on the infamous Admel case." It was like it's the power of the internet, where people find the business case and then go and use it. And funnily enough, these students reach out to me because they think I can give them some additional information that isn't on the web, which is actually really funny to do. Yeah.
And so that was the business that you exited?
Yeah, I was the head of marketing for Admel between 2012 and 2016. And then it got acquired in 2016 by a company called Microchip out of Chandler, Arizona. And in that acquisition, Microchip decided to eliminate the top layer of executives. So the CEO and his direct reports left pretty rapidly after the acquisition, after the deal closed, in good harmony. And we all... I still have a lot of friends in that business. As a matter of fact, I still do business with them because of the Arduino engagement.
Okay. Are there any lessons from that acquisition that people could learn on the back of your experience?
You know, I think Microchip has been incredibly successful stitching together a bunch of acquisitions. They've been the darling of Wall Street for a few years in a row, and you can see how they have successfully created a whole bunch of shareholder value in the last couple of years, which I think if there's one lesson around it that people can learn, I think they stitched together dozens, I don't know what the exact number is, but dozens of acquisitions, which is quite something, right? Because having to integrate these people into your own culture while maintaining your own culture is... a very difficult task, but they have been very successful. And as a shareholder, I still wish them continued success.
I've got a few questions left. One is specific to you. I've never asked this of anybody before. So there you are in California. What is it that you miss about the Netherlands? Not the weather, I guess, but...
Yeah, not so much the weather. Well, I got great friends, right, to start with, obviously, that I miss, because sometimes it's nice to be able to call someone in the same time zone, as opposed to catching someone at a crazy hour where they're either winding down or whether they're thinking of breakfast. The Dutch directness and ease of doing business is refreshing, right? I think Californians would call me blunt and a little direct. But once you're amongst other people that are blunt and direct, things speed up pretty significantly. So I miss some of that. Now, after 10 years in Silicon Valley, I've also come to the realization that sometimes the Dutch bluntness can be a little bit too much. But yeah, you know, it's always nice to be able to communicate in your own language with sort of your own people. It sounds a little benign, but that's just what it is. And then, of course, there are some food in the Netherlands, not the highest quality food. You have to probably be genetically trained to be able to appreciate it. But there are some of the food that I still enjoy. And when I go back, I indulge.
Okay. Two questions that I do ask every guest I get on. The first one is, knowing what you know now, is there a time you'd go back to? And knowing what you know now, that thing, you'd be able to avoid it, or you'd be able to do it quicker or better? Or,
well, you know, I don't want to sound like you had like granddad on your podcast, right? So I'm 46, so it's not so for listeners that go, what the heck is this guy 90 years old? You know, I think we sometimes should be appreciative of the things that we have or had. So I worked for Frans van Houten, who's currently the president and CEO of Royal Philips in the Netherlands, right? Headquartered out of Amsterdam. One of my best times were with him. He wasn't necessarily always patient with me, and he shouldn't have been, but I learned a lot. And I think I could have appreciated, though I did, and I think he knows I did, appreciated that time a little bit more, but also being able to then enjoy it a little bit more. And we were getting a lot of work done in a very intense environment. I enjoyed that time very much. I learned a lot. So that wasn't necessarily answering your question, by the way. I realized that.
No, that's fine. It's always interesting just to get whatever springs to somebody's mind when I ask them that question.
Yeah. Well, there's a more recent one, which still frustrates me, to tell you the truth, right? I help these companies. I walk in, I see the same problem over and over, right? There's people that say, I don't think we need any marketing because we know all the customers that we have to talk to. That's one. The second one is, our technology is so amazing that I don't think we have to talk about it, right? The third one is, let's communicate more speeds and feeds. And it still amazes me how long it takes me to be able to explain to people that they have to change their mind. And you would think that after, I don't know, 25 or 30 of these engagements, you'd think that I have been able to crack the code on accelerating the process. But I'm incredibly impatient by nature, so that probably has to do with it as well. But I'm like, dude, how long is it going to take you for you to realize that we have to go do this? Because there's like 30 cases and history around the fact that I'm right. That's never a really great statement, and I'm also not using that statement, but that's interesting, right? That's also not an answer to your question, by the way, because you said, what did you learn? I think the attempt of us to pour all of this into an intellectual training course based on the book is probably the most elegant way of trying to solve this problem, but I'm still a little frustrated by how long it takes for these companies to realize that they have to really change the way they're doing marketing.
Okay, now that sounds like you're not going to be short of work anytime soon.
No, that's what I'm hoping for.
The last question I have is that there may be some books that you've read along the way that have had an impact on you, and I wonder whether you could share one or two or three of those with everybody.
Well, there's a book called Scale Up. It's interesting that you ask me, because I was featured in a Dutch newspaper a few weeks ago with my top three of books, and I had provided a list. One of them was the Scale-Up example. The other one is a book called Zucked, which talks about Mark Zuckerberg and the Facebook empire and how some of it could be or is or potentially could be a threat to what it is we're thinking and how it is we're thinking and how it is that we're looking at certain things. And it's intriguing to me because I'm right at the center of a pretty polarized society here in the US, especially in the current political climate. And I've already learned to not really make too many statements around the political climate in the last few years. So I'm probably going to refrain from doing that here as well, especially since this is going to be recorded. But the whole Facebook social media impact associated with that particular climate and how it either reinforces or strengthens people's beliefs in some of these echo chambers that people are creating is intriguing to me as a person, but also as a marketeer, because I'm, of course, using in some of my engagements the social channels, and I have to, because some of them are incredibly effective. But I realize that we're sometimes feeding a beast from which we don't necessarily know the deeper consequences. And that's an interesting book to read for people if they wanted to pick up something. And then, of course, I mean, pick up the book, Cut the Bullshit Marketing. That sometimes I always say, hey, you know, I wasn't going to retire from the proceeds of this book because it's not a Harry Potter book. So we decided to make this thing incredibly cost-effective for people. And you can go download even audio versions. So we invested in an audio version. You can go download that. I think it's free. So we're trying to make this thing as accessible as possible. So when you hear me market it, it's not because I think I'm going to retire off of it, because then I should have written the next version of Harry Potter.
Sander, that's fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. And thanks for being a fantastic guest today. Thank you for getting up early to join me.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for the opportunity. It was a very pleasant conversation. I really appreciate it.
All this information and more can be found at dominicmonkhouse.com/podcast. There you'll find show notes, additional reading and links related to this episode. You can also find my blog and the past editions of the Melting Pot newsletter. The simplest thing to do is to sign up to my subjectively, not crap, once a week newsletter, where I'll update you on what I've been up to, the most interesting articles I've read, and all things relating to scaling up, high-performing teams, net promoter score, company culture, etc. Social, you can find me on Twitter at Dom Monkhouse and LinkedIn at Dominic Monkhouse. LinkedIn is probably the best way to reach me and share your questions and comments. Thanks for listening.